This is May 28th. This is Shirley Bradley and Sandy Dragoo, and we're at the CATA offices, and we're just going to chat about her memories of Rio and maybe some of the folks that worked there. And I'm just going to start out by asking you just very quickly how you came to hire into Rio, what you were doing before that.
I had been staying home for about 10 years raising children, and we moved to Perry. And my husband was minister, and so that was a new church that we had. And we had two churches out there, Perry and Shaftesbury. And I was itching to get back to work for a little bit, and I had bought a new piano. And so I decided if I worked about 3 or 4 days out of the month, I could pay the cost of my new piano. So we moved in just 2 months, and I went into Lansing to go to Manpower to take a test to see, you know, I'd been a trained secretary. And they said, oh, gee, I mean, you qualify for an executive secretary job, and we've got one this week that starts at Diamond Rio. And I could still remember the lady saying to me, but now this is an executive secretary one, and you might not get, the next time you get called, you might not get paid as much as what this one is. So do you want it, or do you want to not take a higher pay? I thought, oh, isn't that crazy? Why would I turn down the higher one? But I went through it and said, no, I'll take it. And so I was to go and work for 2 weeks for a secretary by the name of Velma Hildebreidel. And she was one of the 9 executive secretaries. And you were an executive secretary. Well, at that time, there would have been 8. And you were an executive secretary at Diamond Rio if you worked directly as the secretary to one of the vice presidents. And we were the only non-union women that worked there. And all the rest of the secretaries or clerks or women were in the union. And so there was this little band of the few of us, and we were the confidential secretaries and all of that. So I had gone in to work in Velma's job, and her job was as the secretary to the vice president of finance. His last name was Reed, R-E-I-D. And so I was there for 2 weeks. And no, it wasn't either. It wasn't the finance one. It was the operations vice president. Can't even remember what his name is now. But I had gone and I'd been there 2 weeks. And about 2 or 3 days before my 2 weeks were up, they had come and said, another one of the vice presidents is going on vacation. Would you go and work for that secretary? So I said, sure. So I was there a month, and I then got done with those two and then was home. And on the second day of being home, I had come home from someplace, and my husband said, Diamond Rio has called, want you to come back. They've hired a new vice president, and they want you to work temporarily for him until they can hire a secretary. And this man's name was Bob Long, L-O-N-G, and he had come from Bendix Corporation. And he was, they had, at that point, and this would have been about in September of 1971, and they were bringing him in to try to get the bid so that Diamond Rio could make military trucks. So he was the vice president of military trucks. And he came in, and he and I instantly fell in love with each other. And he and his wife and his family are still such dear friends of mine. Bob is now close to 80, but still the same wonderful man that he was. And he and I really clicked. And so then it became time that he was to hire somebody. And he kept saying, Sandy, you got to, he always called me San. And he said, San, you got to stay with me. And I said, oh, Bob, you know, I got 3 kids. I got 2 churches. I can't. I can only. Well, he kept at me. And I said, okay, we made the decision that I would. And so then they tried to hire me. And personnel would not hire me, because when they sent me for a physical, the doctor had said, do you have any back problems? And I said, well, yeah, a little. and learned one of those times, and you should have kept your mouth shut.
Hmm.
So then they said, well, you'll have to have a back x-ray. And so they took a back x-ray and said, no, she can't be hired. So Bob kept saying, well, then hire her as a handicapper. Nope, they wouldn't hire me as a handicapper. They just kept saying, you're going to have to go find another one. And Bob was determined that I was going to stay. And so this went on for, hard to remember now, but probably a couple of weeks or so. And all of a sudden, it came through, you're hired. I said, oh, well, okay, because I knew Bob had been pestering them. And so then I worked for Bob, and was upstairs, our offices were upstairs in the Diamond Reel plant.
In the plant, not in the administration?
No, building. In the administrative offices, yeah.
Okay.
You always had to walk through around all of the buildings to get out to the plant. I never went to the plant that much. I mean, some people talk about, well, that's where their area was, or their job got them out there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did win the military truck bid. I can remember I'm doing the military truck bid, and this was something that Bob was very used to because of Bendix, and Bendix having all this background, and that's what they wanted Bob's background for. And so Bob would always take one copy of the bid, and when I had to type up the bid, it was just so confidential. And there was a period of time where there was a weekend, and they had rented several rooms at the Harley, which I'm not sure what the Harley was called, the hotel over here at Jolly and Dunkel. And they had these guys, and they worked the entire weekend. They were people from Bendix that Bob had known, and they were putting together all the costs of what it would be for Rio to go back into the military truck business. And so it was, Bob would say, it's the same theory as what you do anything. And so they had wanted me to come in to type up some of these things as they were working in the weekend. For me, with this farm background of, you know, not going to this beautiful hotel, you know, I look at that hotel now and I think, I thought that was so beautiful in 1972, and was there, and I can remember that Bob had said, well, call Dave and your kids, and they came in and swam in the pool, and they were so excited that they got to come to this pool. But then when I typed the actual bid, the day that it was supposed to be and it had to be opened in Detroit, Bob took one of the bids, and they took the ribbon out of my typewriter so that no one could go back. I mean, everything that we did was just so precise, and that they took the ribbon out so that nobody could take the ribbon and find out what the bid was. And so Bob knew all of these precautions that had to be taken. And then he took one copy and drove in a car to do it. And then somebody else had left like 3 hours earlier to take another copy, so that if somebody stopped you or did all of these sabotage things, the bid would actually get to where it was. And so it was, again, such a new experience for me with all this little cloak and daggers kind of thing. And so they did win the bid, and that was the beginning then of Diamond Reel making military truck.
This
would have been it would have been the fall of 71 that I went to work when they brought Bob in, and it was a few months after, but not too long. I would say the spring of 72 would probably have been about it, because I mean it was such a rush to get him in to get that bid done to see whether they could get that piece of business. So then they were making military trucks again, and it made a big shot in the arm then for real.
Yeah.
And at the same time that Bob was there, there was the gentleman that was the head of manufacturing by the name of Claire Laudenslager. And Claire's whole theme forever had been, The bottom line was, get the truck off the line. The truck, any truck, had to be off the line in order to get it to the dealer, in order to get it to the customer, in order to get the money back in so you could make another truck. So it was, Claire was a no-nonsense, get the truck off the line, and if not, you're going to answer to me, Claire Laudenslager. Very rough and tough. A very different kind of person than Bob Long was. Bob was very gentle. Bob was like my father, like what I'd grown up with. And then Claire was this one that was so rough. And I can remember only seeing him once at Rio. And I sort of, you learned to move over to the side of the hall. You didn't want him to see you doing something that maybe you weren't supposed to be there or whatever. I mean, it was just fear of Claire. And that's all I really knew of Claire there. He was the boss of one of the other executive secretaries. And so Carol and I were friends, but we never really talked about Claire or anything else. I mean, but reputation. If anyone in Rio and in any of your other stories, you will hear the name of Claire more than any other name that there was.
Okay.
He had been there so many years, and all of the plant people then indirectly or directly reported up through to Claire. And so it was the thing of get the truck off the line. And there's a story that I chuckle about with Claire, and then I'll tell you how I got to being with Claire and knowing him probably as well as anybody in this world. And a friend of mine who I still have connections with, and she was an expediter. And an expediter at Rio was the one who was supposed to do all the things to get the truck off the line. They were to keep all this contact with customer and expedite. And if something got slowed down or stopped, the expediter was to go in and get that truck moving again. And she was fairly new in the job. And she had been told there was this problem on a truck. And so she had called one of the guys out in the plant and said, you know, where's this truck? What's happening with this truck? And the guy had said, it's stuck in an elevator. She was very new. So she said, okay. So she talked to the customer and she said, well, I'll keep working on it, but the truck is stuck in an elevator. Well, the customer called Claire. And to Claire, it was like, who is this stupid person? Who would ever tell a customer that there was no elevator? I mean, it was like, where did this thing come from? So he stormed out, found what the problem was with the truck and everything, and then called this friend of mine into the thing. Her name is Marty Toomey. And he called her into his office, and it was just reaming her out for this. And it made her mad to think that this is what had happened and that she was being truthful. She thought that the guy was telling her, you know, it's my job to be the expediter and I asked the question and that's what he told me and I told the customer I did it what I was supposed to do. Sure. And I don't appreciate getting chewed out. And I guess Claire looked at her and said, you are right. And he called the guy up and chewed him within an inch of his life. And that story just went
all over the
this was Claire. One of the other stories of Claire, we had a guy named Jim Cox, who Jim Cox's dad and Claire had been friends for 30 years. And so there were these boys, Cox boys, and two of them then came to work here at CATA in the garage. Hmm. And Jim had told this story, and I still use it. I still use it to this day. One of these where you kind of go, this is who Claire was, and this is how CATA got the bearing, and how CATA got to be who we are in this town, was this drive of Claire's that said, you will do what you're supposed to do, or I'll kick you harder if you don't do it. It was fear motivation. It's how Claire did. But he then had this soft side, but he'd never let outsiders see the soft side. But there was a soft side to Claire.
Really?
And so then I got to I was one of the fortunate ones that saw both sides. I mean, Jim tells a story about he was a supervisor at Rio at the time, and they were to come in on Saturday. And what men had to do if they worked for Claire is that they had to wear a shirt and a tie. If they were in management, you wore a shirt and a tie. I never saw Claire in my 11 years of working for Claire. I never saw Claire in a short sleeve shirt other than if he was going to the golf course. Every other time he would walk in, and it was always a long sleeve, cuffed shirt, and a suit. Never saw him in a sport coat. That was just the way business people were to dress. Clearly how I have done that very same thing here. I mean, it was a value of mine too, but from the man's side, that was clear. And so they would always have shirts and ties. Well, Jim hated. Jim has like a 19-20 size neck, and he hates wearing ties and all this. So he thought, and they always called Claire the old man. And it was not done as a negative term. It was like, the old man will get you for that, or don't let the old man see you, or whatever.
Sure.
And so Jim had not worn a tie that day. The old man walked in, because the old man was known to do that. I mean, you never knew when he was going to be anyway. And so Claire walked over to him and went like this and said, "Do you work for me?" And Jim said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, without a tie on, you don't work for me today." So he said, "You're giving up your wages for the day. Next time you'll put a tie on, won't you?" And Jim said, "Man alive." That's all it took. But he said, "I worked for nothing that whole day." He said, "Claire went, took the day's pay away from me." He said, "And it was time and a half pay." He said, "I had four kids." It was time and a half pay, but he said, "Claire said." And he said, "I knew I was supposed to have a tie on." Those kinds of things would happen, and the guys would never gripe about it, because it was, the old man had made it very clear. You do it. If you don't do it, there are consequences. And Claire always followed through on the consequences. He'd never say, "Well, okay, you know, I have a little touchy-feely." It was like, "You didn't do it. Here it is. Don't you ever do it again." And then it was done. Part of the same philosophy that I do today. I mean, just, there's a bottom line. I do all the hugs in the meantime that Claire never did. But anyway, have that. So, oh boy, talk about rambling.
Jim, could I ask you Jim's last name?
Cox, C-O-X.
Oh, got it. Okay, yes, you did say that earlier. Thank you.
And I could give you a phone number for Jim. And Jim would have so many stories of Rio, because he was a supervisor. He would have been the personal friend of Claire. Jim then married Claire's secretary.
Oh.
And they live in Portland now, but come into town all the time. And so Jim and Sue would be great ones, because Sue would have all of the secretary stories of Claire at Rio. And Jim would have the stories. They have their son is named Robert Claire, spelled C-L-A-R-E for Claire. So there's a strong connection between the Coxes
sounds
and the
like
Longslayers.
It sounds like he was the general that everybody loved,
absolutely.
Did exactly.
The same,
they knew he was right.
The same as what you get with our very high seniority people that would remember Claire. I mean, we sit around and laugh and tell all the old Claire stories, and then I'll go, "So that's the other side of that story. I've known this side all this time, you know." And they would love to get him playing cards or tell him something that they knew he would like, and then Claire would come storming back down, "Sandy, you go take care of that." And then I'd say, "Claire, no, you can't take care of it." You know, it would be an extra board rotation issue. And if you were the next one up to get a piece of work, then you might get an 8-hour piece of work. Well, Claire might not want Joe Blow to get an extra 8 hours. He wanted Jimmy Smith over here to get, well, Claire, it doesn't matter. I mean, we've got a union contract, and first up, first out. I don't want to hear how the board works. I want you to go fix it. Claire, I cannot go fix that. And then I'd go down the hall, and then the guys down there would be laughing, and they'd say, "I bet you Claire came and said you were supposed to change the board, weren't you?" And I'd say, "You guys, I'm going to kill y'all." So to this day, we have lots of those stories. Remember when Claire did
this? Oh, you must have fun.
Remember when Claire did that? I can never get together with the retirees and not have that. We had Claire's son-in-law. We had two of Claire's son-in-laws that worked here, and a daughter that worked here.
Here at Cata,
yeah. Because we picked the people as Diamond Rio was closing.
Oh, that's what I want to know.
That were the best workers. And between who Claire knew, between who Stan Wright, who had worked at Rio for 35 years, and Claire had come to work for Claire maybe a month before I did. And so Stan and I were buddies forever. I mean, Stan was older than my father, so he was another one of these father figures. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes between Stan and Claire, they'd get something going of something that they didn't like, and then it was like, Sandy, go fix that. I'd say, you guys can't do it. But
that's what an executive secretary is supposed to do.
Yeah, huh? Right. Well, the executive secretary was something that, in Claire's mind, titles didn't mean a thing to Claire. He didn't care what anybody was called. It was a matter of you did what there was to do, and you became a master of all things, and the more you did, the more he gave you, and the more power he would give you. But first, you had to earn the trust. And if all of us would say, if you had Claire's trust and you misused it, then you could never get it back. And it was very true. There was then always that hold back, and Claire would hold it back, and you never could regain it. And you knew that. And there were only a favored few of us that ever were able to be able to be in that circle. Now, you had to take an awful lot in order to remain in that circle.
You did.
You never got to let your guard down, or you never got to feel that you had earned it. You were always re-earning it. You were always working hard because that's what you had to do. And people would say to me, why do you do that? Oh, because, you know, it's like, this is what I'm, he's not going to wear me down. He's not going to do that. And I worked for him for the 11 years here.
You were there at Rio for 11 years?
No, I was at Rio just the 2.5, but then worked for Claire here for 11 years.
And when the Rio closed, he came here, or shortly?
No, he was let go from Rio before they closed.
Oh, I see.
He had been let go, I think, 3 different times.
Really?
And then they hired him back. They'd bring somebody else in, and they never could get the truck off the line. And so then they'd rehire Claire back again, under Claire's terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then some new president or something would come in, not like the way Claire got it done. And then it would be, and I think it was 3 times. Now, that was before I was around, so that's a story that I'm not sure how many times, but I think that's accurate.
He must have got so he could clean his desk out in a hurry.
Well, it was, he knew how to do his job,
mm-hmm.
but with Claire, you also had to let him do his job in his way. Nobody could come in and make him be molded into any other thing other than who he was. And if you didn't like it, then either you had to go or he would leave the whole thing, because he just wasn't going to be molded for any reason.
He sounds to me like the kind of person that every executive or every owner of a business would want.
Yes.
Because he's getting results.
If you could allow him to do things like the pulling on Jim Cox with no tie. Now, you get a president in who is a very soft kind of one and wants everybody to be happy and everybody to feel so good about their jobs, and this is a real love-in. Then you take Claire's style of management and you couldn't tolerate it. Because then you'd hear, what do you mean you went and told that guy? You can't let him work and not get his pay. Why, that's going to be against some law way out here. Claire would say, to hell with it. I don't care. I told the guy he's not getting paid. That guy will not get paid. And Claire would have laid down for the thing, saying, you will not undercut me. And Claire would never allow anybody to then make it softer. It's, you do it, or else. And there were always or else's. And it was Claire. It's how he got the truck off the line. Customers could get to him. The
He was approachable?
Oh, yeah. But you had to... You had to play it Claire's way. And Claire had enough confidence in what he was doing that he just wouldn't back down for anybody. Didn't need to. He didn't need to.
It sounds to me like your time there was, although it kept you on your toes constantly, it was a challenge every day. It sounds to me like I'm hearing that it was a good
thing. Claire and Bob did not like each other.
Hmm.
And their styles were very different. And so as Bob was wanting these military trucks, the military trucks had to be merged in with commercial trucks.
I see.
I mean, you had to sell these and you had to sell these, and so it made a huge drop into manufacturing. And so then as Bob and Claire would sort of go at, why aren't these trucks over here getting done? Well, it was then Claire was saying, well, you know, this commercial truck is going. I got this to be done. So they never really liked each other. And because their styles of management were totally, totally different. And so anyway, after things happened at Rio, and they terminated Claire, and then they terminated Bob Long, it was when Capert came in as president. In a period of time then, when Capert had come in, followed Jack Adams, who had been the president, and Capert brought in a person that was seen as the hatchet person. Her name was Mildred Johnson, and she was the hatchet person for Capert. It's when they did all the negative things with the pension that the guys who had put their lives into Rio lost pensions because of what Capert had done. They wanted the place to close, and that was part of, I will always believe, it was part of what they had planned, that they were going to take those funds and put them in other of Capert businesses. And so when you talk to any of the older people that their lives had totally been Rio, and then to have someone come in and take their pension. As I have been here now for 30 years, and I know what pensions mean to people, and know what these real people that came to work for us then, and they were starting all over with not being able to have a pension from Rio, and then be able to build a pension from CATA. CATA pension was all they had. And so it was such a sad time, because then people were just being let go and let go and let go, and they let Stan Wright. Stan Wright had been there like 37 years or something, and it was just a very hurtful time. It was sort of like you didn't know who was going to get shot next.
Mm, mm, mm-hmm.
And then they did the same thing with me after they had me stay for quite a long time after Bob had been fired. Then there just wasn't any other place to go. Then they put me in with another vice president that had been an outside guy. His name was Duff, D-U-F-F, and he was such a negative thing for Rio.
Oh, and, really?
So negative. He was brought in from the outside to kill that part of it. And
he was brought in on purpose, too.
Yeah, he effectively did it. I think he's probably one of the very few people in my life, if I ever saw in an afterlife, that I would turn the other way. There are a few, and he would be one of them. But then it was after I left Rio, then that, and this was in January of 74.
Thank you.
And then I got a call from Claire at this place named CATA, that was a bus company in Lansing. And he wanted me to come to work for him as his executive secretary. And I thought to myself, that guy is smoking dope. I wouldn't anymore go to work for Claire Lanslager than I would go and jump off a mountain. I mean, I remember how scared I was of him. But I couldn't not go in and talk to him and tell him face to face that, no, Claire, I mean, this would never work. and had the interview, and he said, "I don't need an interview." I go, "Yeah, I do. I need to come in." So I came in. It was in our old building downtown. Newspapers up at the window, rats. We were in this condemned city house. The garage was where Ariel's museum is now.
Yes.
All torn. It was in such shambles. Garage would flood. We were in the floodplain. It was a terrible place. And the more he talked about what he wanted in a secretary, that's what I love. That's what I'm going to be forever. I don't want to be anything other than a secretary. And so he'd been asking me all these questions, and so then his question was, and so now what is it that your husband does? And I looked at him. It was sort of like a defining moment. We chuckled about it sometimes afterwards, and I looked at him and I said, "Claire," because you never called him Mr. Loudenslager.
You'd meet
him the first time, and he'd say, "My name's Claire," and he was Claire to everybody. No one ever called him Mr. Loudenslager. I've never heard a person who knew him that would call him anything but Claire. And I said, "Claire, you can't tell me that you were ready to hire me without even talking to me, and that you have talked to as many people as you say you've talked to about me, and not know my husband is a preacher." And he looked at me and he said, "Will he try to save my soul?" And I said, "No." He said, "All right, I don't care whether he's a goddamn preacher or not." Okay. I said, "Well, let's try it for 30 days. Because I said, I don't think your personality and my personality are going to really match. Let's try it for 30 days, and each of us can walk away, and we'll be friends." "All right." And one of the things that the other boss, this Duff, when I went to work for him, and when they were going to transfer me over to him, and first time I met him, and he said, "Few simple rules that I have." I said, "Okay, what are they?" He said, "I want 12 pencils sharpened and on my desk every morning. I don't want 11 pencils. I don't want 13 pencils. I want 12 pencils sharpened on my desk. Do you think you can handle it?" "Yes, sir. I think I can handle that." And that was about all you had to do for him. He'd go in and shut the door. And the reason that I was told by personnel, when they finally would tell me why they let me go, is, and the personnel guy should never have told me this, but he did. And he had said, "Mr. Duff said that you have a bad habit of treating salesmen as if they are real people, and he doesn't like that." And I looked at the personnel guy, tears running down my face, and I said, "And that is exactly why it was never going to work." I said, "I have been on a 2-week Christmas vacation." And I said, "This is my first day." And I said, "I was coming in today to resign because I can't work for someone like him." And I said, he beat me to it. He was in early, and he never came in before 10 o'clock or so. And I had thought, gee, maybe he really missed me in these 2 weeks. He was talking to me about how was vacation and how are the kids. First time he'd ever talked to me. I thought, my goodness. He said, "Well, this is what we're going to do. You, what are you?"
Really?
Another one of the reasons of why, for me, in now having been the director of CATA for almost 20 years, is that when I've had to terminate someone, it has always been with so much background of letting the person know what behavior they had to change or what the rules were. And I can so honestly say, and I've had to terminate many, but I could look them in the eye and say, "You knew what you were doing. And we tried to change this behavior and it isn't doing." But it was such a heartbreaking thing to have that be it. So, you know, here were the Claire and I that were sort of with the same things happening to us from Rio. And I never told that story about Rio for so many years. It was so hurtful to me, and I just, people now don't even know that that's the reason. Mm. I mean, only a few people know that. But anyway, it was that whole part of some of those negative things that happened at the end that made it all so undesirable and so negative, and all of that. But the interesting thing, I want to go back to that original story that I was telling when I was talking about getting hired at Rio.
Mm-hmm.
And my office used to be right across the hall here, and this was Claire's office. He had come in, and he always jingled change in his pockets, and he'd put his hands in his pockets, and we'd always laugh. We could always tell when the old man was coming, because you could hear his change. He'd put his hands in there, move that change, and we'd think, oh, the old man's coming. He'd come in, and he'd walk around behind me and look out the window. There were dogs. Darn dogs are still out there, too. And because here, he always saw that he didn't get to see houses and real things happening in the street and all this. He'd walk over in my office. And we got talking about something. Don't even remember what we were talking about. And he made a passing comment. And he had said, well, the second time I hired you. He went on and I said, wait a minute, what'd you just say? And he said, well, pretty bad when I have to hire you two times. You never hired me two times. I said, I came to work for you. I mean, I knew that that's what had happened. He said, how do you think you ever got that job at Rio? And I said, well, personnel said that I got hired. How do you think that happened? You didn't think it happened because of your boss, that wimp. And I said, well, yeah. I said, I know how much he worked with him. I said, he could have never made that happen. He said, I'd heard the story about here was this secretary that knew what she was doing, but that the stupid personnel department wouldn't hire you. So he said, I picked up the phone. He said, Carol told me. The friendship with Carol. I mean, it's another one of those of when you go back to one thing, building on another, and how my life could have been so terribly different if this wouldn't have happened and this wouldn't have happened. And he said, Carol was telling me, he said, I checked it out. And he said, yeah, just because you got this bad back. And he said, so I just told him, make it happen. And I said, you're kidding me, Claire. No, by God, I'm not kidding you. I never, you know, there wasn't anybody left in personnel. It didn't, I mean, he had told me that, so that must have been what happened. But all those pieces, then it kind of went, so that's how that happened. But again, see, it was the difference of Bob tried to do it the right way. Claire saying, this is stupid. They're not going to do it until you say, do it. And you had to have enough power to do it. And so Claire would use his power if he felt it was the right thing to do. Now, he wasn't going to be debated with, or he wasn't going to do any of these other things that somebody else might do. If it felt right to him, he'd just do it. It was in. Don't want to hear any more about it. Try to thank him. No, I don't want any thanks. And one of the other stories of Claire that as the history of Claire, and as I said earlier, I probably know and have a closer relationship with Claire than probably anyone.
Sounds like it.
Well, two stories. At his funeral, he died of a heart attack on 4th of July, 1985.
Hmm.
And his family had called my husband to see if he would do the funeral. And again, this was one of those, and Claire very much respected Dave. And because it was that, well, yeah, Dave didn't try to save his soul. And Dave did his service. I thought, I don't know how he's going to do this service, because it was one, well, how was anybody ever going to do a service with Claire when you had so many people with so many different experiences and stories and harshness, and but yet here would be the Claire who would go out on 10 limbs to save you. But if you lied to him, you were done. I mean, you just knew all of those things about him. And so I kept thinking, how's this going to be? And so Dave started out by saying, many of you people don't know me. You know my wife, and I'm Sandy's husband, and I'm going to base my sermon on the two faces of Claire. And he said, some of you only know the one face. Most of you here know the other face, the harsh face. But he said, through Sandy, I had the privilege of knowing both sides of it. And he said, that's what we're going to talk about. And the quote that Dave used, that he molded the whole story around, was that Claire was a person who could use the church hymn of just as I am, and it was so true, and that Claire would take no excuses of himself or would make no apologies for himself. It was always a matter of, I am just who I am. Mm-hmm. And that phrase is on his tombstone.
Oh, yes.
Just as I am. Mm-hmm. And he's buried over here on Mount Hope. And that phrase, so many people afterwards said they could never have believed that Dave would be able to pick that up with Claire. Because Claire said, if I stand up here and talk to you about Claire did nice things and he did this, he said, you'd be saying, that's not the Claire I know. It would be the Claire of don't have a tie on, no pay. But he said, the reason you're here today is that for some reason you saw a spark of that other side of Claire, or you wouldn't be here to pay honor to him. But you know, that one was the Claire. But one of the other things that Claire would always say, if anybody ever tried to scare him or to beat him into submission or try to get him to not do something that he was going to do, Claire would say, and this was a phrase that he would always use, I've been scared 29 times and you can't scare me. Kept thinking 29 times. And you'd go to talk to him about it, never tell you. He was never going to tell you what those 29 times were. We had gone to Washington for a legislative meeting here at CATA. And he had wanted me to go to Washington with him because I was doing more and more of those things as he'd keep giving me more responsibility and all this.
I knew you could handle it.
And he had said, I want to go to that Air and Space Museum, the Smithsonian. You know how to get there? Yeah, I can get you there. All right, I want to go. Okay. So we went. We went up to the display of World War II. He said, I want to go to World War II. Okay. So we looked on the thing and we got up. Now, my dad was never in the service, so I didn't grow up with a military person in my life. So many of the things that Claire would talk to me about, they'd be, and he'd get going on about. My grandkids do that every hour. There's 3 seconds of my grandkids talking
on
that
clock.
On that clock, it has their picture, and then.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. They when I got this, this past year, I got the National General Manager of the Year for all over the country. And so they had a big celebration in Salt Lake City, and my kids all went, and they got me all these awards over here, and that was one of the things that they got me. And so we were standing up there, and Claire was looking at all of these planes, and they were hanging from the ceilings, and a plane of this and a plane of that. He'd always give me such a hard time because I didn't know the difference between a B-47 and a B-52 and all of those. How can you not know that? Well, you know, Claire, I was born in 40. And, well, yeah, but when you got to be an adult, you should have paid more attention to that. Don't you know yeah, Claire, I do. And so I was always on the edge of not knowing what he was talking about. And then he'd always put some little twist in, oh, yeah, you don't know any of that. Yeah, right, Claire. So he was there, and he was showing me that's a B-something, and that's a B-something else. And all of a sudden, he got really quiet. And he looked up, and he said, see that plane right there? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that's a B-something. And he said, see in the bottom of that plane, that little narrow place at the bottom that's like this? And he was at a point that it was like he was almost talking to himself and that I wasn't there. Because it was such a, I mean, he just kept talking. And he said, I crawled into the belly of that plane 29 times and dropped bombs 29 times. And that's why nobody can ever scare me in that life. He said, I got scared 29 times. That I was never coming out of the belly of that plane, and looking at it, and it was such a small, just a long.
Oh, it's just a narrow catwalk.
And he crawled in there and would drop the bombs, and he said, 29 missions in that plane. It was such a moving thing to me.
You must have had tears.
Oh. I mean, I can remember it as if it were yesterday.
Hmm.
It's another piece of Claire that, see, the rest of the world never would have seen. Because he would never share that. He would never say what happened to him in 29 times. Because that would be letting people in to his inner being. And he kept the doors locked to that. To the rest of the world. The rest of the world would only hear the term, you can't scare me. Don't you dare try to scare me. Don't you dare try to use that with me. I'll get you more than what you can ever get me. And it was just clear. It was, you deal with him fairly. You deal with him right up front. You go behind Claire's back to do something. And he will turn around and he will find you behind his back. Because it was just, it's a little like when you hear someone now talk about their street smart.
Mm-hmm.
Claire had had so many things in his life where he had got snookered, is probably the best term I could use. Told about when he was a kid, would have to go and again, these were stories that only I would ever hear about Claire. And something would bring up something as he would be walking into my office and standing there looking out. And he had to go, boys, in those years. And see, Claire was born in 1921, June 21 of 21. And so when they got to be 10, 11, 12, they would go and stay with a farm family to earn money for shoes and clothes and such to wear to school the next year. And that's what they were to do. So, to Claire, the way he saw it at least, and I don't know whether it was true or not, but the way Claire saw it is, some of these doggone farmers would cheat you. And then he'd always go into, but you know, now that's not your dad, because my dad was a farmer and I'm brought up on the farm. And the farmer, to me, was upright and would never do anything like this. But Claire would always make it be, no, that's not your dad, because I love your dad. But boy, in those days, those farmers would try, as it got later in the summer. You didn't get money until you got all done with the job. And as the summer went on, they kept turning the screws down to try to get you to be a baby and go home. And then they didn't have to pay you for all the work that they had. So he said, by God, they weren't going to do that to me. But he said, they keep trying and keep trying. And then he told the story that he was told one day the farmer was going to be gone. And the farmer told him to take that pile out there in the barnyard and that whole pile of rocks and stones, and he wanted them put down at the other end of the barnyard. So Claire said, I worked all day hauling these stones to the other end of the barnyard. I said, by God, I got it all done too. And he said, you were never to ask why you did anything, but he said, I just kept wondering, what was the difference between if they were here or if they were there? And so he said, when the farmer had got home, I had said to him, I got that job all done. Can you tell me why I did it? What are you going to do with them down there? And he said, the farmer had said, I didn't have anything else for you to do, and by God, you weren't going to sit here and not do anything. I only did it just to keep, make sure you were working all day. And so again, to Claire, it was this, that was pure crap to him, that anybody would treat a kid that way. He always saw kids as being, he would love kids. He always had a coin that he'd give to a kid, or see what Claire's got for you here, or whatever, because he saw, and Claire had three daughters. And those daughters were the apple of his eye. I mean, those are my girls. And the oldest daughter is 6 months younger than I am, and she and I are still good friends. And then the middle daughter worked here, and she and I were friends. And then the younger daughter never worked here, but her husband did. And his youngest daughter died of cancer 2 years ago.
Oh.
But Charmaine and Dawn are still going strong. And Dawn lives in Florida, and Charmaine's son-in-law, so Claire's grandson-in-law, is a mechanic in our garage back here. And but you know, those are the pieces of Claire that I feel on this whole thing of doing the history of Rio that are such an important part, because probably as that history gets told about, it will be harder and harder for people to really catch that flavor of what Rio was and what Rio meant to so many families in this town. And so many of the things with the bowling alley and the movies and those that you read about as pieces that people talk about, you know, that are probably would be 80, 90, 100 years old now. I never knew any of that because that was all gone. They still had the clubhouse, and as I'd said, there were these 8 secretaries, 9 after I came, after they'd hired Bob as another vice president. And we were the first group of people that were ever allowed in the men's club, because the men's club was the non-union supervisor, manager, man. And so that had been the camaraderie, the boys.
Fraternity.
The boys.
Mm-hmm.
But then they had the union. But then they had the 9 of us that didn't fit any place. And so we were the very first group that then started going to the men's club. And
you were non-union, you secretary.
We were non-union. The 9 of us were non-union. We were, the title clearly was, we were the executive secretaries. To my knowledge, I don't know of any of them that are still alive. But I don't know that. But when I couldn't name them all now. But Carol, the one that had been, she was my age, and she had died, oh goodness, probably 15 years ago. It was after Claire died.
Well, this is a wonderfully unique portrait of a man that so many will have memories of, as you say, from different viewpoints. But I really appreciate this. Has been wonderful.
Well, you say you wind me up and I get going.
Well, I could sit here all day and listen. This is just wonderful. Is there something else that you'd like to add that I hadn't even thought of covering? I've got a wonderful picture of how you felt about Rio, how you felt about the job, how you felt about the way things were done. I usually ask people, are there any last thoughts about Rio or something else you'd like to contribute?
Oh, I think probably in my job now as the head of CATA, and, you know, we run buses, which is our business. And
mm-hmm.
all of that time when the real buildings stood there, and then going through all of the contamination of the real buildings and the grounds and what were they going to do with it and all of that. To so many people, they don't remember that. I mean, they look at what Washington Avenue is now, and hard to picture going back when that was just all filled with buildings and the plant out there. And the plant was a dirty, loud manufacturing plant. It covered that whole block. And then to start seeing building by building torn down and dug up and out, I think it is so good that they finally have what they're calling it, the Diamond Reel Way. And you know, the few years ago when they put the sculpture up and they did the painting on the side of the building. For those people who weren't there, it's, oh yeah, that was where the old plant was. And I had such a small part of that. I mean, when I think about, if I wouldn't have then come to CATA to have had the close relationship that I had with Claire, my short time there would not have meant near as much. I mean, it was there. I have those good memories of it. I am still such good friends with so many people that I met there in just that 2.5 year period of time. But it would have been a very different one. It would have been a whole lot more in my past than what it was with then being here with Claire all those years and him giving me his insights into what happened and the stories then that Claire would tell me. And I could only visualize all the plant out there and to kind of picture what things would be. There was one other story that I chuckle at. This is still this Jim Cox. And he had then come as the head of our garage here. And so one day, Claire was in my office, and Jim was in my office. And we were talking, and they were, you know, they'd get going on about old real stories. And I'd be doing, I wish you guys would go, you know, in my head, wish you guys would go back over to Claire's office and so I can get my work done, you know. And so, because some of the time just didn't appreciate the piece of history that I was getting, you know. And so Jim was in there, and they were doing ha-has. And so Jim started telling this story to Claire. And he was saying, did I ever tell you how we knew when you were coming out into the shop? And Claire was going, no. And so Jim just blundering his way right through it. And he said, well, remember so-and-so, and yeah. And Jim said, well, I mean, we always needed to know when the old man was coming out into the shop. And so he said, the first one, they'd hooked up, they'd had the electricians hook up these switches. And so when the first guy up in the administration building knew the old man was going out into the plant, because Claire was always one of these, any time of the day or night, he'd walk in to see what was going on. And that was his way of keeping track. He didn't want 10 reports of paper. Like, God, you get off your rear and you get out there where the action is. And so one would flip a switch and the light would go on. And then when he'd get there or wherever, the next guy would flip the switch and then there'd be a light going on down there. So it was like, the old man's coming, the old man's coming, because the light was on. Claire stood there and looked at Jim and I thought, oh my gosh, I could see it coming. He was so angry. And this had been, I mean, goodness, this would have been maybe 82, 83. I mean, this would have been 20 years after it happened. But to Claire, it was the matter that somebody got him.
Oh,
somebody had got him. And all of this time that he had felt that he was just walking out there to see what he could see, and then to find that this Jim Cox, who was this kid who had grown up as part of Claire's family, that he had been a part of that turning the switch. And oh, you could just see Claire seethe. And he let Jim have it.
He did.
And walked out of the office. And you could just see Jim's face just fall. It was like, why in heaven's name was I not smart enough to know that the old man wouldn't really like to hear the story about how we got him? And Jim and I will chuckle about that sometimes when we see each other.
He found a chink in his armor and he didn't appreciate it.
Yeah, he did. Because, you know, again, if you think back to all of the things that I've said, that was the Claire. It was, Claire knew what was going on. Claire was going to make it happen. Claire did make it happen. Claire could do all of these things. And he did it through his head. And then what came out as being, you go do this and you go do this. And people never would say, well, why? And you take that back then to the Claire story of the stones in the barnyard. And he'd ask why. And it didn't make sense to him why you'd have somebody just doing unnecessary things. See, I had told Claire the story, and of course Claire had very negative feelings about the people that had let him go from Rio, and then he knew that they'd let me go. And in that interview, I had told Claire the story about the 12 pencils, because the 12 pencils to me, as a business school graduate, to be an executive secretary, and then to have some stupid boss sit there and make my job be so demeaning that I was to have pencils sharpened for him, was, it made me so angry inside. It was like, I'm worth more than that. Now you give me a job to do and I'll do the job. So when Claire was interviewing me, he had been talking about, and I'm not one that's going to sit and look over your shoulder, and I hadn't even told him my story of Duff. He said, the way I work is, you've got your job to do, and I don't look over your shoulder. By God, when you need something to get guided on, you come to see me, but otherwise I do my job, you do your job. Could you live with that? Thinking, man alive, he's giving me the freedom to go back and do what I think I do very well, not to sharpen 12 pencils.
Yeah.
My kids know that story of the 12 pencils. I mean, I've told that story so many times on how stupid you can make employees feel when you do stupid things. And no, I mean, I'll say to somebody here, why would you want to do that? What's that going to gain? You know, no, we will never demean anyone. But then I had told that story to Claire. He was so angry. Claire had heard me ask the story. When I told Claire the story about that was what Duff had wanted me to do, it made Claire so angry because it was such a demeaning thing. It was picturing what this guy had done to me in how that was demeaning to me. And here was Claire that knew how to build trucks and make a profit for the company. But yet here's this other idiot that sat up there and fired Claire. It was like, how can you do it when what you're supposed to do is to get trucks off the line?
Huh.
For me, it was like, how can you do that when you paid me to do a job? Not to sharpen 12 pencils. Gosh, tell me you want pencils always sharpened. It's part of the job. Sure, you'll always get them sharpened. You schedule it in your head and every morning you make sure the pencils are there.
Sure.
But the 12 pencils was the stupid part. And it was such a piece of stupidity. Kind of like how some parents make kids do something so stupid. Move the rocks from one end of the barnyard to the other. Just because I'm not going to trust you to not do anything. I'm going to make you do it because I got the power to make you do it.
I have the power. Yeah.
Is then so derogatory to what anything should be.
The rocks and the pencils are so symbolic.
Yeah.
of their own behavior and motivation.
Yeah. And then the airplane and the crawling into the belly of the plane.
Yes.
And all of those things that were there.
Isn't it fascinating? All these things that go to make up a person, and then sometimes nobody ever knows about that, those pieces.
Right. And that's where then in my head I go back so often to that I was so fortunate to get to know so many of those things.
Yes.
See, I don't really know whether sometimes even Claire's daughters would have known, because it was very hard for Claire to share his internal. The daughters, Charmaine and Dawn and Sharon, you'd have had to have had him in the right place with the right thought processes. He would never have planned that he was going to see that B-52 or whatever that plane was, and that I was going to be there and he was going to get talking about crawling into the belly. That would never have been in his plan. Oh, gee, I need to tell Sandy why. No, it would not have been that he would have ever thought it necessary or right that I would know what he'd been scared of. He knew what it was. What would be the object of telling anybody else? He would never tell anybody else that. The moral of that story was, don't you ever think you can scare me, because you can't scare me. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very unusual revelation there of seeing what that was. So then many of the things that then in my 11 years of being trained by him and getting a telegram from Claire when I got the job, this job here, and he had said, I knew you could do it, kid. And I kept thinking, man, all of those years when I was taking all of the crap, and after I had got the job, he had said, I bet you wondered why I was always so hard on you, didn't you? I said, yeah, I did, Claire. Many, many times. Many, many times I was going to walk out the door. And I said, there was something in my stomach that would say, you're not going to beat me. You're not going to win. And I had so much of that, a lot of that from my own upbringing, but such a very different upbringing. I mean, my dad was always treated so well by, he was the only child, by my loving grandfather and grandmother, that my dad could never have told me a story about working in a barnyard and moving the rocks. I mean, this was my granddad and my dad who taught me that you had your own self-being and pride, and that you were always to be without stain and without blemish, and that you were to do things because they were right and they were Christian and they were all these things. So I came from this farm background, the most naive person that could be, and then finding myself and loving my boss. When I worked, when I was first married, and Adrian, he and I are still friends. He was the city manager. He and I are still friends. He's retired up in Midland. Soft-spoken, would explain things, what it was, loved his wife and kids, and then stayed home for 10 years, and then worked for Bob Long, who was still my buddy and my mentor, but he's the greatest guy around. And here was Bob Long. And then all of a sudden, I get Claire Lunsley that does it with these three men that have been, and being married to a preacher. And these three men, my dad and Cliff Miles and Bob Long, that were of this kind, wonderful family people, just would never do anything that wasn't totally explained out and everything else. And then here I am with Claire that you had to keep working on to figure out, and you'd think you're getting figured out. And he would also say, don't ever try to figure me out, because I'll do something that'll make it be that you can never figure me out. I have told that to some employees that work for me. Don't go jumping ahead and say, oh, I know Sandy would do this. depends on what the circumstances are, depends on what the long-range part is in the head. You never can think exactly because you don't. No two people ever have the same background of learning. So you see things just a little different. And so you never can say, this person is going to do it this way. Because for whatever reason, it may not be that way. And you learned that from Claire. You'd try getting too far ahead of him. Boy, you'd get yanked back. You weren't to be that far out there. And you were to be knowing what that was supposed to be. And so in that 11-year period of time, I got to see glimpses and pieces of Claire that, like I say, I just don't think were probably shared with his wife Ginger, because Ginger would have seen the part of Claire that was the father, the husband, and she wouldn't have known the people associated at work or all of those other things, either at Rio or at CAT. I mean, she'd know some, sure, but again, I spent more time with him on a daily basis than what anybody else did. And so a very important piece of my life of who Claire was and who I am. And
how he still is with you.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Learned from Claire dealing with how you dealt with the union. Learned it a piece at a time. Had never had any formal training in it. And it was, there was a line, and you do everything that there is up to a line, but everybody has to know that there's a line, there's a consequence. This is the way it will be, and if you push, always remember that I got more power than you do. And I don't want to ever use that power, but by God, I will. And you learned that from Claire. So there were all these things that I would do with the union. Come on, guys, let's go. Let's get it done. Let's get it worked out. And so all of those 11 years then, because as I went then from executive secretary, and then Claire had said, you want to do this personnel stuff? I mean, you're doing all of this. We were getting too big. I couldn't do it all. So then I hired a former executive secretary at Diamond Rio to take my place there. And then I'm over here doing this personnel work, starting to negotiate contracts with the union. I'd never dealt with a union in my life. Never. And so then it was negotiating contracts. And Claire sitting at home. And the last night then, you know, being at the end of the phone. Yeah, you got another quarter of a penny. Then I'd go back in there. I mean, talk about learning by the seat of your pants. Was certainly what I did. And so then as all those things kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then, you know, the influence that is here, and the way that the relationships with the union, I mean, the president of the union, when I was trying to get this job, and then in writing by the search firm, had a guy out of Atlanta, Georgia, that the board hired to fill this job permanently after I'd been doing it on an interim basis for 6 months. This guy would not bring my name back to my own board of directors to even have an interview because he had said, a woman cannot do this job. And only because of this very strong friend on the board that from General Motors, that I had earned his respect, that he took the chance on me. And here I was, I had a business college degree, didn't have a four-year degree. I mean, I was this secretary, but the president of the union at that time came to the board and said, you will be fools if you don't put Sandy in here. Sandy's the one that knows how this place can run, and she will make it work. Mm-hmm. And when I think about to this day, the relationship I have with this union. And this past year I got this National General Manager Award for all transit managers throughout the United States and Canada. And a system our size never, ever, ever in 20 years of this award has got this award. It's always the New Yorks and the Chicagos and the San Franciscos and, you know, the huge cities.
Big visible.
Transit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when I got that, I was the third woman to get it. And the first one of a small system. And so that award and having my six kids go to Salt, my three kids and their spouses go to Salt Lake with me for that. I had five board members that went. I had six staff members that went. And I had the president of the union that went. And it was a week like no other week in my entire life. And you know, so much of, again, those pieces of how one thing adds to this thing, adds to this thing. And you go and pull out any of it, and it would crumble because the pieces that you got are what made the tower work. And so I go back and, you know, how did I get that award? I got that award with, you know, lots of hugs, lots of heartache, lots of all of those things of learning from Claire, getting slapped by Claire by, you know, what to do that for? And then it explained. Or I'd go out and do something that was right because it was right. And then I'd come in and, Claire, it's the right thing to do, and I'd have to argue with him. But he kept giving me more and giving me more. And it's the only way you're going to learn it. And I would always say, are you going to cry? And I'd look at him, I'd sit in this office, and I'd say, you will not make me cry. And I tell you, I could have counted the steps from this office to that restroom down there, because I would keep saying, if I can only get to that bathroom, if I can only get to that bathroom, and it would be my thought, and I always made it to that bathroom, because by God, you were never going to see me cry. And he did. But it was another one of those tests. You can't be a pansy ass. I know, Claire. You've got to get out all this stuff out of your head that the world's going to just lay down and make everything right for you. Yes, Claire.
And, oh, dear.
You can't be a pansy ass. I know, Claire. I'm not a pansy ass. And all of those things, you know, that have made it into who I am and that influence of Claire. The influence of Claire. And the influence that he had of this place and what, I mean, we're the only two directors that's had. Well, I shouldn't say that. There were two other ones that stayed about a month.
Oh.
But Claire was director for 11 years, and then I've now been almost 20. And so everything goes back. I mean, there are very few people. I think there's maybe three union employees that have been here longer than I have, and I'm the longest administrative person. And so some of the people, you know, that come here to work now, they hear the stories of Claire, but they have absolutely no idea what it was like when Claire was here. Mm-hmm. And
you have to work with somebody on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah.
And even then, Mr. Laubesleger sounds like not everybody gets in.
Oh, you know? Oh.
So there aren't very many people that would get to
very,
know.
Very few people got in.
Well, you've certainly created a wonderful portrait here, and this is this is wonderful
what
information.
We got an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, I thank you so much.